It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we're going to talk about the history of beards in Wisconsin with historian Erica Janik.
Before that, we're talking teachers. It's the first day of school for lots of Wisconsin, and our guest says now is the perfect time to reevaluate how we think about teachers.
He's here to explain what he means and how we can change our perceptions about the educators in our community. Neil Heinen is with us. He's editorial director of Madison Magazine and WISC-TV. Neil, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob and Veronica.
So why do you think we need to change the way we think about teachers?
Well, public schools have been an issue that we've followed as an editorial board on the TV side for, you know, most of the 20 years we've been doing editorials. And Madison Magazine is also starting to pay a little closer attention to public schools and the quality of our schools. And as part of that, I've just been thinking about some of the challenges that our schools have faced. And over the years, this idea that teachers have become sort of political footballs, going back a few years, often with labor issues that were tough and sometimes were hard for communities to understand. But more recently, with things like Act 10, this idea that teachers are responsible for the failures of our kids and problems in terms of public servants, in terms of their salaries and benefits, have just obscured their contributions.
So, what are the contributions? What's the value of a teacher?
Well, you know, as I said in the column that I wrote, you know, some of the most important decisions I made in my life were influenced by teachers. And I suspect that that's true for a lot of people. Good teachers can profoundly affect our lives and the direction of our lives. But more importantly, you know, just the role of the modern teacher, of preparing kids to be citizens, of preparing a skilled workforce, of preparing kids to be global citizens. It's hard work, and they're really doing, by and large, quite a terrific job at it, and they do not get the credit and respect that I think that kind of work deserves.
Well, a lot of critics of the teachers' union will highlight it that way, saying teachers were fine with them. It's the union that was the target of Act 10. Is the battle over labor obscuring the day to day role of the teacher?
Sure, it is. And I'm not suggesting that I wasn't really looking at it as dealing with the teachers' union. That's sort of a separate issue. I understand it's important. It plays a role, and I acknowledge that in my column, but as we look at some of the countries that are really doing a very good job of educating kids, and of course, Finland is sort of the hot pick right now as an exemplary country for public education, those countries tend to hold teachers in high regard. Their status in the country is much different than their status here. And what I'm suggesting is that we start there, that we begin to look at teachers as innovators, and as I say in my column, even as entrepreneurs, that kind of thinking, the same kind of thinking we see in people, you know, starting up new businesses and creating these 21st century products and information. That's what teachers are doing in the classroom every day, and we could start thinking about them that way.
So how are teachers entrepreneurs and innovators? How does that function on the day-to-day level as they head back to school?
Well, you know, just for example, here in Madison, there's a relationship between Sherman Middle School and some of the folks over at Sector 67, the maker space on the east side. And the principal of Sherman Middle School and the teachers there just have embraced Sector 67 and Sector 67's willingness to have the kids come over and see how these young startups are creating new products and doing things. But just even approaches to education, I think that the teachers are much more creative, much more innovative than they're given credit for. And we should encourage that.
Well, do you think we do that now? I mean, you hear complaints from teachers sometimes, or people who observe schools. They're constrained by their administration, by state policy, by federal No Child Left Behind policies, sometimes by union rules maybe. Is there room for teachers to innovate and think of themselves as entrepreneurial teachers?
Well, you know, Rob, there probably isn't room right now, and there needs to be room. We just simply have to make room. There's a kind of an interesting conversation going on in Madison right now, but with some educators from around the state about whether or not teachers would benefit from having a place where they could go and share information and best practices, to use a hackneyed phrase, but to interact with each other and with other professionals in fields that might be complementary to teaching. Look at it as a teacher innovation center. And teachers and business people, people at the UW are talking right now about whether something like that would be of value to teachers. And I think the easy answer is that, yes, of course it would be, but teachers will need to be given the time to participate in something like that. But I think teachers would welcome the opportunity to have a place, perhaps in proximity to some other more, some of the creative professionals in the area, where they can explore different relationships and problem solving. One of the things we hear a lot about closing the achievement gap, for example, is the importance of teacher training and teacher support. And it seems to me that the schools that are doing the best work and doing the best job of closing the gap are the schools where teachers are sharing ideas about what works and working collaboratively in ways that I think, again, people don't view teachers as doing.
Do we get bogged down in a lot of the same educational debates we've had over the years, federal core curriculum or, phonics versus whole learning? And do those kind of old debates get in the way of new ideas that might completely sidestep some of those older concerns?
Yeah, I think absolutely they do. I don't have the solution to that, Rob. I wish I did. I mean, I'm trying to be a little provocative here and challenge people to change the way they think about the role of a teacher. Those debates about about curriculum, about even labor issues, those are going to need to happen. I mean, this is a profession, and it's going to take time for some of those to change. But I think if we looked at teachers differently, we'd look at some of those issues differently, and we wouldn't allow them to take over, to dominate the conversation about education and what we as a nation want for our schools and our kids.
So you've made this provocative argument that teachers need to be treated as or thought of as a higher status. They need to get more respect. Are you optimistic that that could happen in Wisconsin?
You know, this is pretty new. But yes, if we believe that things that happen on a small scale can expand on a larger scale, then I believe it can happen. I mean, I'm feeling pretty optimistic about what's going on in Madison schools right now. There's a new energy, there's a new excitement, and I have talked to teachers and I've talked to teacher union representatives about the new superintendent, about her approach, and about something else that I identify in the column that I think is kind of important, and that citizens who feel a little uncomfortable about how this whole debate has gone in the last few years. And using Act 10 as an example, I think that there are some people who just they may agree with some of the goals of it, but they don't agree with how it was done or how it has affected teachers. And I think there's some new interest right now in repairing that damage.
Right.
And so I think there could be some enthusiasm for, as I say, thinking about teachers differently, just in terms of the status of the profession.
Neil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Neil Heinen, editorial director of Madison Magazine and WISC-TV.
Coming up, Erica Janik fills us in on the legacy of beards here in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Believe it or not, there is such a thing as the National Beard and Mustache Championships, and they're happening this weekend in New Orleans.
Autumn is a traditional time to grow a beard, for those who can actually grow a decent one. Not me. The beard boom started a few years ago, but it's still going strong today, from natural bristly beards to manicured steampunk styles.
And as it turns out, Wisconsin's got quite a legacy when it comes to beards. WPR's resident historian and producer of Wisconsin Life joins us now to share some of it. Erica Janik, thanks for stopping by.
No problem.
So when I think beard, where I go is Paul Bunyan. He seems like he has the original lumberjack beard, and, you know, he wore flannel with it, which exactly the right fashion choice. So can Wisconsin claim the original lumberjack beard?
I think we can. You know, I particularly, you bring up Paul Bunyan. You know, that's really kind of that prototypical lumberjack. That's what we all think of. And, you know, he's very masculine and virile. And that's kind of what that beard symbolizes. And, you know, while many states actually, you know, make claims to Paul Bunyan, sorry, Minnesota, the first stories about Paul Bunyan actually do come out of Wisconsin. And so I really do think we have this long history of, you know, the lumberjack beard, you know, which you can see today on the street in that kind of urban lumberjack look that's everywhere.
Right. It's kind of synonymous with the hipster look now, right? Like the long natural beard and flannel.
That's true. And, you know, beards have long been associated with that kind of creative type of person, the artsy person. You find that all throughout history as beards kind of wax and wane in popularity. But you do often find them more on the like artist, hipster types, even in the 19th century.
Well, there is a beard history here in Wisconsin. I know because you've dug up a lot of it. Tell us a little bit about this Dodgeville Hermit fellow.
So there was a guy and his name was Archibald MacArthur. And he actually came to Wisconsin after the Civil War. And he was a very successful attorney. And then he ran a newspaper. And then later in his life, in the early 20th century, he kind of decided to give all that up. He had become a fairly wealthy man by that time, but he sold all of his possessions. He decided that the law really wasn't for him anymore. He sold the newspaper. He became a vegetarian, and he did something kind of radical for the time that kind of symbolized his outsider status, is that he grew a very long beard. In the early 20th century, beards were out. Beards had been in earlier in the mid-19th century, but by the early 20th century, there was a brief mustache phase, but he really went for the full beard in the 20s and 30s, and beards were not in at that time. And so, you know, that was kind of a symbol that people knew that this guy was, you know, kind of out there, is that he had this big long beard.
Do we have a picture of this guy?
There is a picture of him. He was very well known, actually, in the area. You know, he was very well known just being a lawyer and owner of a newspaper. And then, of course, as he took on this more eccentric life, more people became fascinated by him. And actually, late in his life, he bought a car and drove down to Florida and ended up giving his entire fortune to a man he met on a park bench. So, you know, kind of an eccentric end, marked with a beard, as the beard often symbolizes some kind of eccentricity.
Oh, that's what happens when you have a beard. You give away your fortune to a guy on a park bench.
That's very true. Yeah, there's just something about it.
Well, who are some of the other notable bearded guys from Wisconsin history?
Well, I think you find, you know, as I mentioned, beards were very popular in the mid-19th century. And this was kind of a new thing. Beards had actually been out in colonial America. If you think about our founding fathers, you don't think of any of them with facial hair. You know, George Washington does not have a beard. Thomas Jefferson does not have a beard. And really, from Washington through President Buchanan, all of our presidents are very clean shaven, because a clean and open face was kind of associated with that open-mindedness of the Enlightenment. But in the 19th century, as the country becomes more urban and industrial, you know, a lot of people are kind of worried about their manhood being sacrificed. And so one of the ways that you could show that you were a virile man like Paul Bunyan is that you grew a beard. And so you find a lot of, you know, this is about when Wisconsin is getting settled as well. So you'll find all of our early legislators all have beards. And, you know, it actually merits mention in newspapers. There's even a man, a state representative, Francis Little. He was from Mineral Point. And the newspaper actually said, he does not allow the razor to approach his face, nor the shears his head. So he was very well known for his beard. And then, you know, you'll find mention all the time of all of these people wearing beards. There was another man, Governor Jeremiah Rusk. He was our Wisconsin governor from 1882 to 1889, and he actually became the first U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, a notable accomplishment, but he was also very well known for his long beard.
Well, in terms of politics and bearded fellows, was Lincoln the president who really hit it out of the park, who brought the beard into the mainstream?
I think he did. You know, I mean, you see some beards. That's, again, that mid-19th century time when, you know, the beards had been out. But then as kind of tastes were changing, then Lincoln actually ran for office clean shaven. He did not have a beard at all. But by the time he took the oath of office, he had a beard. And there are some people that say, you know, that the beard actually really helped him win the election against the clean shaven Stephen Douglas, because, you know, it really showed that Lincoln was an individual. He was a guy who would stand up for his principles, because, you know, these were all these qualities that were associated with manhood, and they could all be kind of imbued in the facial hair.
That's interesting, because I don't think of Lincoln as our manliest president, but I guess in his case, it was some other stuff that it symbolized.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think when we think about what Lincoln looks like now, I mean, and you know, when you see all of the reenactors and the impersonators, you know, they always have a beard. You never really see a lot of Lincoln impersonators that are without
The
beard.
They got to have the beard.
Right. And you know, and at that time period, too, when you look at the Civil War, you know, it's really just an abundance of people with really fantastic facial hair, all kinds of whiskers and goatees and mustaches and mutton chops. It was really big in the Civil War. And, you know, all the big generals, you know, if you think about the ones that were very winning, like U.S. Grant and Robert E. Lee, they all have a lot of facial hair.
Beards have been in style for a while now. I want to say it's been 2 or 3 years, but I guess there were moments in history when people were actually persecuted for having beards.
Yeah, one of the most famous, actually. So again, you know, the early colonial America, even into the early Republic in the early 19th century, beards were kind of out. They were really seen as kind of immoral, and you were suspicious if you had one. And there was a man, his name was Joseph Palmer, and he was kind of a reformer and a utopian, and he lived in Massachusetts. And he was also very well known for a big bushy beard. People used to throw rocks at him. And as, you know, people were walking by his house, they would throw rocks through his window because he was really seen as kind of a suspicious character for having this beard. And one day in 1830, he was actually walking out of a hotel and 4 men attacked him, attempting to cut off his beard. He fought off his assailants. He actually stabbed 2 of them with a pocket knife. And he actually ended up, despite, you know, he didn't start this attack. He actually ended up being charged with attacking these men. And he was fined, but he refused to pay the fine because he didn't think there was anything wrong with wearing a beard. So he ended up going to jail for a year. And just because he refused on principle to pay this fine for a beard that he thought he was perfectly in his right to have. And actually on his gravestone, he died in 1873. There's actually a picture of a man with a big beard, and it actually says persecuted for wearing a beard. So he's very well known for his big bushy beard.
He served a year of jail time standing up for his beard. That's incredible.
Yeah. And actually some of the other prisoners and even some of the guards in the jail actually tried to cut his beard off too. So he really was just under attack for having this beard. And it just really shows, you know, how out beards really were and that people really thought that there was something wrong with you if you did have this facial hair. And it's kind of crazy to think about that facial hair could have so much meaning and actually be so contentious that, you know, people are actually getting openly attacked for it.
So subversive. Yeah. I don't know. Do you think the beards have changed? You look back at this history, and I know you're a historian, not necessarily a watcher of pop culture, but do you think that beards still have that counterculture cachet and that they also carry, you know, the manliness and all of that along with it?
I think they do. I think, you know, it has become a little bit more mainstream perhaps now than it was in the past. But I do think you continue to find this idea of the beard being associated with being very masculine and being kind of on the outside. And, you know, there certainly are still professions today where you can't have facial hair. So I think there is something about it that, I don't know, just signals something to everyone that you know, you're kind of an outsider.
All right. Well, Erica, it's been fun. Thanks for stopping by.
You're very welcome.
That was Erica Janik. She's a historian and the producer of Wisconsin Life here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
We want to know, what do you think about beards? Cool and manly or icky and unbecoming? Should you be attacked in the street for... Well, no, we'll assume you think not. Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also post a picture of a great beard, someone you know, perhaps your own.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll find out what goes into the training of bomb-sniffing dogs.
Also, a new Wisconsin play examines the intertwining threads of addiction and loss.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll be hearing your stories about the first day of school and hear about the life of jazz vibraphone player Gary Burton.
You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, it's the first day of school for many kids around the state, and we'll be talking to you about your first day of school memories.
But first, the music we're hearing is from the latest album by jazz legend Gary Burton. The song is Caminos. The album is Guided Tour. That's him on the vibraphone. He's been at this for a while. His first album came out in 1961. His autobiography is out now. It's Learning to Listen, The Jazz Journey of Gary Burton. Gary, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Nice to be with you.
So for somebody who's been playing music for years and years, earlier in the book you admit you have kind of a love-hate relationship with music. How is that?
Well, I know it sounds strange, but I'm just somehow different about this than most musicians. A lot of musicians, they sort of live the music 24 hours a day. When they're not playing themselves, they're listening to endlessly to records and never have the headphones off. It's saturated with it, and that it makes me almost, you know, like claustrophobic. It's like it's too much. I need to get some, you know, space from it fairly regularly, and I feel fresh when I come back and get my mind into the music and the playing again. So I know that my approach is not the usual one for musicians, but it's what's worked for me.
You think the time away from music from time to time makes you a better musician?
Oh, yeah, it definitely does. In my case, I come back after a break of a few weeks, for instance, of not playing and not even thinking about it much. And then I feel, you know, like I make a fresh start when I, you know, go up on this stage and start another concert, and I feel like what I do is you know, more inventive and different. The thing is, with jazz musicians, you know, we're making up the music that we play is when we improvise. So it's not as if we're playing the same written music each night, and therefore we depend a lot on making it different and fresh and spontaneous each time we play. So for me, I need to, you know, keep having time away in order to allow myself to feel fresh.
Well, I wanted to spend some time talking to you about improvisation because you do it and now you teach it, too. You've been teaching it for a while. I want to read a little bit from your book here, earlier in your career, before your first album, I think. Quoting now, maybe once a night as I was soloing on some familiar song, I'd play a brief melodic phrase or two that I hadn't seen coming. This is momentarily disorienting, like hitting a patch of ice on the highway. I'd get a chill down my back. My heart would race as I played something I'd never played before. That's amazing, that sense that you didn't know what was coming next. How did you develop the ability to almost automatically play something, compose on the fly like that?
Well, it's the same mental ability that allows us to speak spontaneously. You know, I don't know, 5 or 10 seconds in advance exactly how I'm going to word my next sentences. All I know is what generally I want to communicate. And then my unconscious mind goes into the memory banks and chooses the appropriate words and then puts them into a proper grammatically correct sentence. And as it kind of comes over into my conscious awareness, I speak it spontaneously. And then you keep doing that sentence after sentence. That's how we converse And we do the same thing as improvisers. We have a storehouse of musical phrases and little bits and pieces of note combinations, and we have a sense of the structure of how music is put together. And this is all assimilated, and our unconscious mind does the same thing. It makes melodic musical sentences using the same process, and as they come into your conscious awareness, you play them. But you don't, you really, after you get used to doing this, you don't stop and think about them and sort of check them out in advance. As they pop into your mind, you immediately start playing them.
So you're in a sense, learning another language.
It's very much so. In fact, people talk about music being, you know, a universal language and so on, and that's kind of true. I mean, we have tons of different genres and styles of music, so if you heard Chinese music and Indian music and then American music, you wouldn't think they had much in common. But the experience of listening and following music and what the players go through to, you know, make it all happen is much the same as a spoken language.
When I listen to somebody improvise, especially in jazz, I think there's a part of me that thinks, well, either you got it or you don't. You know how to do it or you can't. I'm assuming you're going to disagree because you teach classes on improvisation. This is something people can learn to do.
Well, yes and no. Let's put it this way. It's possible for any musician to learn the basics of improvisation. But to be a successful player, you need to have a gift for it. And in the speech, we call it a gift for gab. You know, this is somebody who's great at telling jokes, great at telling stories, or they're great at going on stage and playing Shakespeare or whatever, but they have a gift for speaking and for spontaneity. I sometimes compare what I do to the good stand-up comedians who have stories that they tell, but they don't tell them the same way every night. They shape it to fit the way the audience is reacting and how they feel that particular night. And they get last-minute ideas to add to the story or take it to a different place. That's what we do. We play the same songs each night, but they always come out different because we're shaping them to that unique experience of that particular night and that particular audience.
Well, not long after the passage I read where you were having this sense of you were playing things you didn't expect to play, you came out with your first album. And let's check out a clip from it. This is Joy Spring from your first album, A New Vibe Man in Town. So you were a young jazz musician. First album comes out with your name on it as the lead guy. What was that like? Did that feel like a turning point at the time for you?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's a saying, you only get to make your first album once. And in fact, I tried making a record 6 months to a year before this one, and it didn't turn out well at all. And I asked the company to put it on the shelf.
You spiked your own album.
Yeah, and let me try again. It just, nothing worked out well with that first attempt. I was 17 years old or just turning 18, and I was still trying to learn a lot about music and about how to make a record and so on. By the time we did New Vibe Man in Town, I had a little more experience, and things went well in the studio, so it met my expectations anyway. When I hear it now, I just listening to that little clip, I haven't heard that record in probably 30 years, it strikes me as, well, I played the song too fast and phrased it a little too stiffly and so on. But, I mean, I was only 18 at the time, so I forgive myself.
All right. And you didn't get to pick the album title, is that right?
No, in those days, the record companies controlled almost everything to do with, even famous people didn't get to choose their titles or their what was going to be on the cover of the records and so on. And I was a new artist, just a kid as well. So RCA, this big, huge company, they, for the first four or five records I made, they picked the titles and chose the covers and the design. And in fact, it's not even me on the cover. It's some model guy walking down the street with his head turned so they can't tell it's somebody else carrying some parts of a vibraphone. I wasn't important enough for them to bother
actually having you at the photo shoot,
having me come in and take photos of me. It was cheaper and quicker just to get someone to pose for it.
We're going to get into some of your later music over time, including your new album this year. You just reminded me. I meant to ask what I told people I was interviewing you. They said, "Cool. What exactly is a vibraphone? How is it different from the things in the same family?" So give us the vibraphone 101.
Sure. This is, as you could imagine, comes up a lot into any vibraphonist's career because they're not as widely seen and in use as, say, the trumpet or a guitar or whatever. There are three instruments in this category called mallet instruments. The marimba and the xylophone are very similar. They both have wooden keys, and the only difference is the xylophone is higher and therefore sounds more shrill, and the marimba is lower and has a nice mellow woody sound to it. And you hear the marimba in Latin music a lot. It's very popular in Mexico and Central America. And you hear the xylophone in cartoon music. As I tell, when the cartoon, when the cat falls down the stairs, a xylophone will, be used to sort of make that sound. The vibraphone was invented in 1930, roughly, and the idea was to make a metal xylophone, use the same concept of a mallet instrument, but make the keys out of metal so that it would have a bell-like tone, and that's where it started. And I think it wouldn't have necessarily survived as an instrument if it hadn't been for Lionel Hampton, sort of the father of the vibes. He took up the instrument in the early 30s and joined the most popular jazz band of the decade, the Benny Goodman Group. And in the course of that 5 years he played with Benny, a lot of people saw the vibraphone. And it was, on the radio all the time and on records, and that got it established, and established it primarily as a jazz instrument.
We're talking to jazz vibraphonist Gary Burton about his career, the world of jazz, and his new autobiography, Learning to Listen, and we have some more clips coming up.
And you can join in. Do you have a question for Gary about his career, about jazz, or about maybe the vibraphone, and maybe you've got a memory of seeing him play? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We pick up our conversation now with jazz vibraphonist Gary Burton. And you can join in, too, with your questions about the jazz world, about getting started, about what it was like playing all these years, and about the vibraphone. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
I'm going to play another clip now, a cover of an Astor Piazzolla song. I apologize if I'm butchering that name, Libertango. Let's give a listen. And Gary, I picked this one out because it's an interesting story you have, bringing together the jazz world with this international tango legend, Astor Piazzolla. You came to tour with him. Was it a big learning curve moving from your world of jazz to his world of tango?
Well, it was. I had been a fan of his music for a long time. I saw him in person while I was on a tour once and played some nights in Argentina, and his band was also on the same bill. It was at the place we were playing as the band I was in, and I was mesmerized by the music. I'd never really heard tango music before, particularly this more modern approach that he was famous for. But out of the blue, many years later, he came to one of my concerts in Paris, it was, and introduced himself to me, and I remembered him, and he said, would you like to collaborate sometime on a project? And I said yes without really thinking much about it, but got nervous as we got closer to it because the music was, you know, quite different. I'm used to improvising a lot, and tango doesn't have improvising. And I wasn't sure how the jazz element that I would bring to the music would fit in, and we went ahead and booked 20 or 30 tour dates and made a record deal to record the thing long before we had ever played a note together. So it was, I was beginning to get worried, but it turned out to be a great learning experience. I loved the music, and he was very patient and good at explaining what he wanted to have happen in the music. The main thing for me was I had to learn to improvise in little bits and pieces. Instead of taking a solo, which the jazz players do, maybe play for a couple of minutes and build a story as they play, he wanted me to improvise for one or two measures here, and then over here, play something there, he would say, or you know, this spot right here, and make something up there. And I had to learn to go in and out of written music to improvise, back to written to improvise, you know, on a rapid-fire basis, which was a new experience for me. I hadn't really had to ever do that before. But I got the hang of it after a while and had a wonderful time. We toured about half a year together and made a record. And then I reunited his band several times. He passed away in the 80s. But we've, you know, all the musicians continued to be available, and we got together, made two more records and a DVD concert of all of Piazzolla's music. It was, you know, one of the great masters of the last century.
And you had some wardrobe issues when you started playing live with them.
Yeah, well, I was used to, you know, I'm a jazz musician. I'm used to wearing colorful clothes. And we had rehearsed and were ready for the first concert, a jazz festival in Italy. And I came down to the hotel lobby and wearing my then current uniform, which was white pants and a sort of a Hawaiian flowered shirt. And there was the whole tango group all in black. And he looked at me and said, "Oh, well, you can't play with us then. this tango can't be done." And I said to myself, "My God, I'm getting fired here the first night before I even played the first note." But then he sort of shook his head and said, "Well, you're the jazz guy, so come on, and we'll do it." But believe me, I went out and bought black clothes the next day for the rest of that tour.
Well, I want to play a clip of you performing last year with another collaborator. This one is Hot House. I think that's the name of the album, too, with Chick Corea. Let's give a listen.
Okay.
Okay, so you've collaborated with Chick Corea a lot over the years. Are you two, is this a composition so far in this song, or is there improvisation going on already?
No, this is the written part.
Okay.
And which goes on for about, I'm going to say, 40 seconds or so. And then we start improvising. And that goes on for 4 or 5 minutes, each of us taking turn, being the lead soloist. And then we play written parts again to complete the performance. That's kind of a
standard
jazz format.
When you play with somebody like that again and again over the years, do you start to get, I don't know, sort of a mind meld? You know where they might take things next?
Oh, yeah. Especially with Chick and myself. In fact, we seem to have that instant rapport even the first time we tried playing as a duet. And we made our first recording back in 72 called Crystal Silence with virtually no rehearsal. We just went to the studio and chose some songs and made up arrangements on the spot and recorded them. And it was so easy. I mean, we finished the whole thing in 3-4 hours instead of 3 days, which we had expected to take. And it's been that way ever since. We've been playing together for 41 years now, and we play every year, do some touring somewhere, and we put a record out every 5 or 6 years or so. And I used to think we would run out of, you know, ideas after some point in time. Maybe after 20 years we'd get bored with each other or something. But next thing I know, we were at 30 years and then 35 years, and we did a world tour to celebrate that year. And we're still going. We still get out on stage and the sparks fly and new fresh things happen. And we keep coming up with new concepts for us to explore. Now our next project is going to be with a string quartet. So we'll probably just keep on going.
Well, we've fast-forwarded through a lot here. I want to play one more track, though. This is from your new album, Guided Tour. Jane Fonda, Called Again, is the track. Let's give a list. This is the one you wrote, I think.
Yes, true.
Now, I went to the middle of the song there to where you kick in on the solo. So I think you had the guitar set it up with the melody, and then you come
in
there.
Yeah. And that's, we take turns with who plays the melody section on one tune or another, and we take turns with who plays first or second on tune. So it isn't always the same predictable order of things. And that tune was... I conceived it as just a very relaxed and kind of fun little jazz waltz. And I was looking for a title that was kind of humorous and not too serious. And that's how I came up with Jane Fonda Called Again.
Had she called? Or
no, I don't know Jane Fonda at all. It was just a funny image that came into my mind. So, that's how titles end up getting picked sometimes. It's... In fact, it's always a danger to name something quirky, because then you spend the next 10 years explaining it to people. But that's the way it goes.
You mentioned earlier working with Chick Corea, worried that the repertoire would get stale for you, and it never did. I mean, is that what jazz is all about? Are we, in your career, your decades doing jazz, talk about how it's been reinvented and refreshed over all these years?
Yeah, that's it. I think the same way that comedians want to, not to go back to the same analogy, comedians want to get new, fresh jokes and upgrade their stories from, on a regular basis so it doesn't become repetitive and routine. And us improvisers, we very much want that as well. We keep adding new tunes to our repertoire and finding new ways to play them even. We take a song that we've been playing for off and on for 10 or 20 years and all of a sudden decide, let's rethink this one. Let's play it faster and give it a Latin time feel and to reharmonize some of the chords and so on and give it a new character. And then suddenly it's like a fresh new tune again. And then we have fun playing it. But we need to reinvent our material constantly.
Gary, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Been my pleasure.
That was jazz vibraphonist Gary Burton. His new autobiography is Learning to Listen. His new album is Guided Tour. We're going out with another track from that album. This one is Helena.
Coming up, we'll talk about the first day of school and invite you to share your memories. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.